Okay, is the sound okay? Sounds okay to me, not too loud. Okay, good. So I am going to talk about the hindrances tonight, what Don mentioned last night. I love the hindrances. They are my friend. So I hope I can introduce them to you or create a relationship with you so that you can also be fortunate enough to have friends called the hindrances. And I think I want to start with this quote out of the study guide. It's in the Anuruddha and Nikaya, and it says, this mind will say, oh, bhikkhus, since that's our practice word now. This mind, oh, bhikkhus, is radiant, but it is obscured by visiting defilements. The untaught ordinary person does not understand this as it really is. So for them, there is no development of the mind. The mind, O bhikkhus, is radiant, and it is freed from visiting defilements. The instructed noble disciple understands this as it really is. So for them, there is development of mind. And the reason I really love this quote, because it seems as though sometimes when I think about the hindrances, I always think of it in relationship to good mind, bad mind. When hindrances are here, we're in bad mind. When hindrances are not here, we're in good mind. And I'm hoping I can maybe point this in a little different direction here. And I want to help you see by sharing this story of something that happened to me when I was younger. Years before I ever came to the Dhamma, I found myself in a very difficult financial situation, and I lived in a shelter, homeless shelter, like an emergency shelter, for about 2 months, me and my two boys. So my youngest was what I called a pouch baby. He was like, all he wanted to do was be down in that little pouch, and he really could care less about anything else. And then my oldest was 5. And so I want to tell you about a time that I was sitting back there, my very first retreat, my first long retreat, first month long, and I was sitting there in the back where I always sat, and I had this memory of this situation come up. And when this memory came up, it changed my understanding of what I was doing. And so this is what I want this is why I want to tell you about this story. And so what it was, I mean, I'm sure there was I could give you the whole backstory on how I ended up in an emergency shelter, but really that is irrelevant to what was happening that I want to share. And every morning, Raymond's the oldest, and I and Thaddeus would get ready to go to work, and I had to catch a bus to take Thaddeus to the daycare, another bus to take Raymond to school, kindergarten, and then another bus to get to work. And so we would have to get up early, like 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'd start this process at 5:30 in the morning. So every morning, Raymond, he's 7 feet tall now, but at the time he was still way taller than a 5-year-old. And he would try to skip and get me, are we going to have time to get coffee? That's what he wanted to know every morning as soon as he woke up. Are we going to have time to get coffee? Do you think, Mama, we're going to have time to get coffee? And I'm like, not if you don't get ready. So work on that. And we would go downstairs, and I caught the bus right in front of the shelter, and there was a coffee shop that was right there at this bus stop. And so every morning I would get me a cup of coffee, and I would get Raymond a chocolate milk. There's no coffee in the cup, nothing, not even hot, but I would give him chocolate milk. And why this barista decided to put it in a coffee cup, I have no idea. But of course, Raymond thought he was getting coffee. So we would sit at the bus stop and wait for this bus. My mind was pristine. It would be so quiet that it's downtown Seattle, and every once in a while there would be a car driving by, and I could hear the car driving by. It was during a time when it wasn't particularly raining or cold, but I just remember feeling Thaddeus breathing, being in this pristine moment and listening to Raymond blow on his chocolate milk and ask me these questions about life. What kind of job did I think he should have? What did I think of the president? How was finances in our lives? Did he need to actually work? I mean, it was constant all the way. And when I was sitting in the back here, what I remembered was the steadiness of my mind, the pristineness of it, the tranquility that I had. I mean, I'm sure I was in a really bad situation, but that is not what I remember. What I remembered was the stillness, the tranquility, this pristine mind. And for me, that mind was not my normal mind. I had ADD, I still do. I'm extrovert, so I'm always looking for stimulus of some type. And I had trauma, so I'm always impulsive, overreactive. That energy is always around me, floating around all the time. And the mind is aggressive. So here I was sitting back there, and what I realized in that moment was I did not have to make my mind still. It already knew how to get there. What I had to do was develop the capacity to access that stillness, not make the mind still. And that shift in my understanding changed my relationships with the hindrances. Because without the hindrances, there is no way to develop a still mind. If you are if your mind is still, what are you developing? It's already there. If you are awakened, what are you developing? You may be practicing like the Buddha did, but there's nothing to develop. The mind is free, it's liberated, it's still. So here we are, unenlightened beings, we are developing a mind. Developing a mind, and to do that, we need the hindrances. We need them to show up in our practice. So I'm listening to all these talks, and I realize that we can give this kind of impression that this still mind is what we're going for. If I could just get to that, whatever that pristine still mind is, that then I would be okay. And I want to maybe tweak that a little bit so that you actually recognize the stillness that is present when the hindrances are present. They are enclosed in it. So a couple of quotes that you can hear it. Ajahn Chah, who's famous for his understanding and his expression of the relationship between suffering and stillness, one of his quotes is, "If you want to understand suffering, you must look into the situation at hand." The teachings say that wherever a problem arises, it must be settled right there. Where suffering lies is right where non-suffering will arise. It ceases at the place where it arises. So if suffering arises in you, if suffering arises, you must contemplate right there. You don't have to run away. You should settle the issue right there. And trying to run away from suffering is actually running towards it. So that's one way I want to point to it. And the other way is Thich Nhat Hanh says that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas suffer too. The difference between them and us is that they know how to transform their suffering into joy. And like good organic gardeners, they do not discriminate in favor of the flowers or against the garbage. They know how to transform garbage into flowers. Don't throw away your suffering. This is what I want to point to, is that if you just get into this habit of trying to push away the hindrances, then you are missing the value they actually can bring to your practice. I think that this concentration practice that we're coming into, what I think happened to me in that moment when I was sitting at the bus stop, was I had access to an embodied mind. And this concentration practice is cultivating our ability to access an embodied mind. But we have both an embodied mind and we have an ordinary mind. And we're not going to get rid of either one of them. What we are developing, I think, is a relationship with an embodied mind that is as strong as our relationship with our ordinary mind. And learning to recognize that is the gift that the hindrances bring us. So just a little bit about this ordinary mind, if I could share a little bit about it. It's very rational. And I was a trial lawyer. I was just telling these guys, trial lawyers for 25 years. I needed that rational, analytical, evaluative mind. I can't just throw it out and say, oh yeah, that's not a good mind anymore. I need to have the still, quiet mind. In fact, there were judges and defense attorneys that used to hate it when I would come back from retreat because they were like, God, can we get on with it? Because I would be like very slow and methodical. They'd say, is there any way you could take a couple of days before you come back to work? Is there any way you could settle down a little bit and get back into an ordinary mind? But I mean, it is a different aspect of mind, true enough, and one is good in one place and one is good in the other. And what I begin to realize is that this ordinary mind is not good in the present moment. It's too nebulous. It's too transitory. It moves too much, and it cannot be controlled. It can't be held on to. It's impermanent. It is full of changing and just it's not readily controllable. Whereas ordinary mind, this mind that we live out of, is based in habit. It's very much controllable. We know exactly what's going on because we do the exact same thing. And we set everything up so we know where we are. We know how to do it. Everything is fine. So all of our hindrances our friends are really the habits that we live out of that help us feel right as rain. What's normal? What's me? I know what's going on. I know where I am, and I know what's happening. And when we begin to get more in this embodied mind, it's much more intuitive. It's much more based in the present moment, and it is not trying to control anything. It rests with whatever. You will hear me say often that the ears do not have this understanding of good sound, bad sound. They just know sounds. I hear them all the time. There's a sutta. I couldn't find it. I really tried to find it. There's a sutta. I think it's Malankaputta. I think that's who that the Buddha was talking to. But he says, he asked this practitioner, one of his students, he asked him if he gets upset about sounds that he can't hear. And I think he probably thought about it for a moment. He's like, no. Well, if you do, you get upset about things you can't see? No, don't think I get upset about that either, you know? And the more he went through all the sense doors, if you don't have a connection to it, or a kind of a attachment to it, we don't care. The ears don't care, the eyes don't care. There's no caring about nothing. So in the moment, you have some attachment. Now you're going to start caring about it. You're going to start having some issue with it. Either you like it or you don't like it, some preference, some here or now. And the ability to see that attachment, to see that moment that there's a gluing together, that is, I think, the job of the hindrances, to help us see that. And like what Don was saying last night, it is in the brilliance of Buddha's path that we can actually see it, because we can feel it in our bodies. We can know we are in a habit or in a flow that that these hindrances are present. And concentration is a little different than vipassana with the hindrances. So in vipassana, we're trying to do a lot of investigating of the hindrances, and we're establishing mindfulness through this kind of investigation. But in concentration, it's more of recognizing their presence and this capacity for restraint, this capacity to be able to let go of it. So I'm a DPP mentor, and one of the homework assignments, I always wanted to do DPP, and so I live vicariously through my mentees, and whatever homework they do, I do it too, so we can all kind of like, I've always wanted to do it, so this is my opportunity. And so one of the homework assignments, I think it was last month, there was this point where there was this writing where the Buddha had mentioned he had three powers. He could think, he could wait, and he could fast. And I wouldn't think of these as powers, but I think these were the Buddha's superpowers. And I have a granddaughter who's like 7, and she asks me regularly now, what kind of superpowers do I want? And I'll tell her something like, oh, I want to be smart, I want to be nice, I want to be kind. She said, that is not superpowers, Grandma. I'll give you a superpower. You need to have muscles, be the strongest, be the fastest. You have to see through walls. I mean, things like these are what superpowers are. But the Buddha's superpowers of being able to think, what I would say, recognize, right? You have to have the capacity to recognize something. Back when I was at the bus stop, I never recognized what was happening. I was living in it, But I didn't know what was going on at that time. I didn't have any idea the nature of mind or anything. I was just living through a moment in time. But you have to have this power to recognize what's going on. That's what we're developing. We're developing an ability to recognize. We are developing an ability to wait, to be patient, to kindly have this capacity to wait for things to shift and change. Because we live in this world of impermanence, we don't need to have the control that comes with permanency, because we have this power to be able to wait, to let things move and shift on their own. And learning to be patient and to wait and have this kinder, softer relationship, then this is what we're doing. It's one of our superpowers. And this ability to fast is really his ability for restraint, for renunciation. He had the ability to have restraint on his mind, on his body, on his actions, thoughts, everything. He had this ability for restraint. And everybody in this room, by just the fact that you've practiced enough to be on a month long, you have these same superpowers. These are not some random thing that other people have that you don't have. What really, I think, when it comes to dealing with the hindrances, it's whether or not you trust your mind is the mind that we've talked about in all these Dhamma talks. I mean, Dhara's Dhamma talk last night was so beautiful. And I mean, Don's Dhamma talk last night was so beautiful in that it just painted this picture of the kind of mind that we're trying to have access to. But I kept thinking while I was listening about all the minds out there that are saying, yeah, that is not my mind. That is not us. That's for them. That's not for you, because that's not your mind. And that sense that somehow or another, other people's minds can be calm and peaceful and mine cannot. Other people can get concentrated, but I cannot. And really, all of our minds, I think it's part of the brilliance of Buddha's practice, is that all of our minds can develop towards concentration if we learn to recognize the presence and absence of these hindrances, and we learn to wait and be patient with this kindness and have some restraint. All of our minds, because it is the nature of mind to be this way and not your mind or my mind. So once I begin to realize this, I begin to treat the hindrances in a different way and had a sense that they were actually helping me develop the mind, this kind of still peaceful mind I always wanted. So let's talk a little bit about these hindrances so we can kind of sense into them here a little bit. This first one, desire, it's this wanting mind. It has an unrealistic relationship with pleasant. And so most of it, when we think about it, we think of it as this striving mind, which is part and parcel of this striving to get some peaceful mind, striving to get some pleasure. And we have a thought, or we have this mistaken belief that if I get this thing, I will, or get this state of mind, I will be happy, pleasant, it will be peaceful. This is what I got to get. So our eyes are on the thing out in front of us, striving to get there, striving to get to this place. And we're nowhere near where we are right now. But there is another way that desire shows up that we don't always talk about. And it is when some good state, some pleasant still state has arisen, and we become enamored by it rather than practice. We kind of stop practicing because we're like basking in the bliss of it and we're not practicing anymore. And we're actually setting ourselves up for that state to break down at some point, catch us off guard, and now we're miserable. Like, what happened? I had it, and then I lost it. And we get caught in that because our eyes are relishing in the pleasant rather than beginning to see that kind of leaning into the pleasure. We don't see the unrealistic nature of our leaning into this pleasure. So what we're trying to do with this hindrance is actually begin to notice this relationship we have with the pleasant, whether we are, for those of you that have this very still, peaceful mind, are you just basking in it? Because I'm telling you, in a few days, you're going to be on the other side of that mind. It's kind of just flowed right on out. And so if you're basking in that pleasure, you are not developing a mind that is aware, that recognizes pleasurable states and this wanting it to stay. You can't see that. That's what we're trying to see. So it's not, oh, we got to poo-poo the pleasurable state. You want that pleasurable state, both whether you're striving to get it or you are basking in it. You want to see your relationship with pleasure. And that is an everyday, all-day occurrence to begin to see your relationship with pleasure. That's more important than whether your mind is pleasured, whether your mind is in a pleasant state or not. Can you see the wanting of pleasure if it's not in a pleasant state? And if it is in a pleasant state, can you see you're holding on to it so it doesn't go away? And so either way, you're going to need to notice this relationship you're having with pleasure. And no one state is better than the other. They're both going to lead to dukkha at some point. One is going to lead to the dukkha in the striving, and the other is going to lead to the dukkha in the breakdown of that mental state. Likewise, it's the opposite. In the aversion, you're having this aversive, we can all kind of see that that irritable, kind of annoyed, angry mind. We can see that mind and we can say, oh yeah, I'm angry, I'm irritable, yeah, this is just, I'm grumpy, I'm in this state. But we're not outside of the state. What we're actually trying to see is that that aversion actually can be a little pleasurable. It gives us something. For those of us that have that aversive mind, oh my God, we got plenty to do. We got to work out this problem and that problem, and we are on it all day long, meditation after meditation, and we redo it. I mean, it's just very, it's sucking all our energy. All the energy that comes with practice gets sucked up by all of this pleasure we get in solving all these problems and constantly battling and reliving events and settling scores and all of that that's going on is really just taking our energy. Because when we meditate, we are cultivating a lot of energy. So if you're not putting that energy back into the practice through mindfulness, then your mind is going to suck that energy into all these aversive stories that we are just going to spin in. And so this aversive mind is really just taking up the energy that we are not using to put back into the practice. But we can't see that because we are wrapped in the pleasure. It seems weird to call it pleasure because some of those mind states are pretty aggressive, but they're so habitual. We are so used to them that it feels normal. It feels right. It feels like me. And so we just let that mind suck all our pleasure away. All our energy away. And we do not put that energy back in. I like when the Buddha describes these hindrances out of these water. I know you guys have probably heard this example, but he uses color as an example of desire, and he uses boiling hot water as an example of aversion. And the reason why I like this example is because in the sutta, he says, a person with good eyesight can't see the hindrances when they are all-consuming. So he assumes you are a good practitioner. You know how to see things. You are in the process of developing your mind. But when the hindrances overtake us, we cannot see. We have good eyesight. You have good practice. You cannot see. I can't remember who it was that asked me this, but one of the yogis in one of the meetings over the last couple of days said something about, I just see all these hindrances. And they were saying it as if the seeing of the hindrances meant that their practice was not very good. And I had to correct them, say that if you see the hindrance, you are doing a good job. You should be patting yourself on the back, saying, oh, I see you. I see you. I see what you're doing. Because when we are overcome by them, we cannot see them. No matter how good our eyesight is, no matter how good our practice is, we cannot see it. And that's why these mental states of pleasure and bliss fall apart, because we cannot even see the conditions that are leading to that mind state that's going to fall apart. We're like basking in it and don't see the train wreck that's going to happen at 6 a.m. when you wake up at 6 and all of a sudden you're in your sit ready and it does not happen. It's just thinking, because now you have all this energy you haven't been practicing, and now the mind is gobbling up that energy, sucking it out, using it to think. I used to not understand that PT, if you do not actually begin to use it into the practice, it can show up as arguments, anger, a lot of frustration, irritating, complaining, because the mind has all this energy and it needs to do something with it. And so if we're not turning it back into the practice, we are. I would sit there and wonder, why am I thinking of all this angry stuff? I'm not angry. And yet I cannot stop the subversive thinking. And it's because I'm using my energy to think rather than using it to practice. And so that's what we want to talk about a little bit. But that noticing is not, oh, I have this aversive mind. It is trying to help you see that you are not using your skills to cultivate mindfulness and steadiness of concentration. So then we get to the energy levels, sloth and torpor and restlessness. And sloth and torpor is this kind of, we call it sleepiness. I wish we didn't call it sleepiness, because it's not, you're not really sleepy. It does feel kind of like with the head bobbing that they're sleepy. But one thing that Bhante Buddhirakita helped me really understand the difference between this sloth and torpor and this restlessness is that sloth and torpor, he said that you can think of sloth and torpor as the relaxation and the concentration. So this concentration mind is much more grounded, solid, and think of it as heavy. So it's keeping you right here. Whereas mindfulness is this lighter, interested, more uplifted energy. So if you have too much concentration, too much relaxation and stillness, but not any mindfulness, it will be sluggish. You will be heavy. It's almost like drawing me down. That's what I think. I'm like, oh, ah, oh, that energy. And then if you have too much energy to practice, to establish mindfulness, but not enough stability to actually steady the mind, then it gets restless and very, very active. And so this balancing that we're trying to do is both have a relaxed, steady groundedness and enough interest to stay here. So it's very difficult on the sloth and torpor, because when you come into a room with all these meditators and there's a lot of stillness in the room, we just ride in on that stillness. We don't have to do any effort. We just ride in, and it's so beautiful. And it's so still. And you will not notice that you are losing your energy, and it's getting lower and lower and lower. And then halfway through the sit, you feel the sluggishness because you haven't been putting energy into this interest in your anchor. You've just been kind of here with all that energy. Or you can come in this driving energy and completely bypass the stillness that's already in the room, because you're going to get to your concentration and completely miss the mark. Just have all this energy flowing up and not be able to rest or settle. And so the two examples that make so much sense to me is water that's algae and slimy over the top. You can tell that it's just been kind of sitting there for a while, no movement. It gets all slimy, algae. And then the restlessness is this agitated, swirled up water. And that's the kind of place that you want to be. So these examples that he gives, these analogies, to me, is what I begin to think. How does my energy feel? Does it feel slimy, sluggy? Does it feel swirled, whirled up, and stirred up? And begin to see that. This energy, so when you are cultivating, when you're in these states, you want to begin to see this is not sleepiness. This is sloth and torpor. You want to see that. You can feel it. It's all groggy and sluggish and all of that. And this is sloth and torpor. And call it that rather than sleepiness. Because the sleepiness will lead you to believe that you're just tired. That's all this is. But you're not going to develop the mind. But if you call it sloth and torpor, first of all, who talks like that? But so that's why you call it sloth and torpor, so you can feel it as sloppy and slimy and algae. You can feel it that way. And then it is the simplest thing to open your eyes. Even if you don't have the capacity to stand up, open your eyes. It is so simple, but once you open your eyes, all this light will come in. And much of that sort of slothiness is coming because the eyes are closed and there's all this darkness and you don't have enough energy. So you need a quick infusion of energy. If we, you know, when I used to go to church, my mother used to have candy in her purse and she would pull it out to pass it down the line to get us all to stop talking. Just suck on this candy instead. But no candy in the hall here, so you're going to have to open your eyes. Just that's it. Just open your eyes. That's it. Don't have to stand up. Nobody even knows that you have opened your eyes. Just open them. It's a game changer. It's so difficult to do, but I have to say it so many times because it's difficult to open your eyes And yet it is a game changer. It is a game changer because you're still steady. You have the steadiness of stillness, but you don't have the interest. So opening your eyes brings in this interest without you trying to force yourself to get interested. On the restlessness, we have to almost let the, you're doing the opposite. You're actually steadying yourself and you're trusting that that energy will settle down, that the swirling of the water is only swirling because your thinking mind is swirling it all up. But as you start steadying yourself, even though you're steadying yourself with the swirling energy, it will settle on its own. It's sort of like a guy and the baby getting on getting on their mom's lap and settling. The way he told that story, she was kind of tired and she was snuggled up with her mom to kind of go to sleep. So she's kind of already settled. So a better way to begin to understand restlessness is more like a kid, a child, an infant who has been at the big celebration, the family barbecue, and they've been passed from one person to another, and now they really need to go to sleep, and they're like wired, and they can't settle down. And so you have to hold them in this still place. If anybody's ever had kids, you just hold them in this still place. And they are crying. And every once in a while, they'll settle down, and then they'll be quiet. And then they'll start crying. And they'll kind of settle down, and they'll start up again. And gradually, they settle down. Not because you make them settle down, but because you are settled with this agitation. So when that restlessness comes, you're settling to just let it be. And when you label it as restlessness, instead of anxiety, worry, all of those words we use, which prompt the mind, our ordinary minds, to have to fix anxiety. It has to fix our worrying. But what that worrying and anxiety is doing is grabbing a hold of the excess energy that you're not putting back into practice. And it is stirring up stories in order for us to have something to do with that energy. Anxiety, worry, all this stuff gets stirred up. So instead, we want to begin to put this energy back into the practice, which is what I'm going to talk about here in a second, how we do this. The last thing is this doubt. And doubt is, Joseph Goldstein calls it the mother of all hindrances. I don't know why he calls it the mother of all hindrances, but it definitely, it is the hardest one to kind of deal with, because it is couched in this sense of wisdom. We think we really understand what's going on here, and really we just don't have any faith in our practice. We don't have any faith in the capacity. It's almost as if the fact that this practice is so simple that we cannot trust that this simple practice is going to lead to the inspiring stories that we hear, because our ordinary mind is so complex and so complicated. We think that is more true than the simplicity of the practice. But actually, the simplicity of the practice is why everyone in this room can cultivate concentration. Everyone in the room can develop the mind, because there doesn't require some added special skill. Some, you got to come from special people, special worlds or whatever. You have to come from certain, you have to have a certain degree of, knowledge or intuitiveness or intellect. You don't need any of that. It doesn't matter. Even with a mind like mine, I couldn't attend to anything. And yet, even in the midst of having a mind that has a hard time attending, I learned that the present moment, with its constant moving, changing, shifting, moving, that for an ADD mind, that is heaven on earth. Nothing is staying the same. It's all moving, shifting, changing. And it took a long time for me to see that that is more stabilizing for me than being in this mind that I think is supposed to be still and permanent and solid. That's what I thought I was going to, that I was supposed to move my mind to. But it's not. It's in this fluid, moving, changing mind that is beautiful for a mind like mine. So how do we do this then? I want to give you a couple of, this is the way Ian McCrory says. He says, "My hut is leaking," said the novice, "and my stairs are rickety." "Wonderful," said the abbot. "There's no need to thank me." "We get the same food every day and not enough of it." "Excellent. Again, no need to thank me." "My hut is too close to the village. I can hear their festivals." "Perfect. No thanks necessary." The novice goes, "I keep telling you how terrible everything is, and you keep saying it's wonderful." And the abbot says, "And wonderful it is. The world, just as it is all we need to achieve liberation. Misery is the compost for the flowering of Dhamma. Without imperfection, growth in Dhamma would not be possible. In a perfect world, we can only attain complacency. In an imperfect world, we can attain enlightenment." And this is what these hindrances are actually doing for us. They help us stay out of this expectation of this complacency of perfection. And they bring life to the moment. So here's another quote from Alice Walker. She says the same thing, a little differently. She says, "Some periods of our growth are so confusing that we don't even recognize that growth is happening. We may feel hostile or angry or weepy or hysterical, or we may feel depressed. It would never occur to us, unless we stumble on a book or a person who explains it to us, that we were in fact in a process of change, of actually becoming larger spiritually than we were before. Whenever we grow, we tend to feel it as a young seed must feel the weight and inertia of the earth as it seeks to break out of its shell on its way to becoming a plant. Often the feeling is anything but pleasant. But what is most unpleasant is the not knowing what is happening. Those long periods when something inside ourselves seemed to be waiting, holding its breath, unsure about what the next step should be, eventually become the periods we wait for. For it is those periods that we realize that we are being prepared for the next phase of our life. And that in all probability, a new level of what she calls the personality is about to be revealed. But I would say a new level of wisdom is about to be revealed. So in some respects, you would not be here but for your practice with the hindrances over the years that you have been practicing. This constant practicing with the hindrances has been steadily cultivating a capacity within you that you are now in a position to realize. And so there has to be a sense of gratitude for this ability to see it and then practice with it. One more way of looking at the same thing that I'm pointing to comes from Milarepa. And Milarepa, if you don't know, he was quite a person. He had a lot of hindrances to kind of work through from his own mess and his own striving and anger and all of his adversities. So his way of saying the same thing is a little bit more direct. He says, when you run after your thoughts, or in my case, when you spin around in hindrances, you are like a dog chasing a stick. Every time a stick is thrown, you run after it, like the mind throws you a stick and you run after it. Instead, he said, be like a lion who, rather than chasing after the stick, turns to face the thrower. One only throws a stick at a lion once. So technically, this is what we're doing. We are not wanting to keep running after the mind. And the gift of concentration, if you don't think of concentration as the mind state you hope to one day get, and you think of concentration as the process of steadying your mind, the development itself, then your anchor is your stability. It is the thing that stabilizes you. So the capacity to stabilize your mind when there's wanting or desire, this willingness to stay with your anchor. I mean, we are going to cultivate into metta and into the awareness practices, but for these days, stabilize the mind. Even if you are feeling pleasurable states, stay with your anchor. Don't turn away from that anchor to the distraction that comes with the pleasurable states. Just stay with the anchor. Or if there's this all of this energy that's coming with all this aversive thinking, come back to the anchor. It's okay. It's just know it. That's energy. That's all it is. This is energy, and I'm going to put my energy in this anchor. Come back to the anchor. Come back to the anchor. Come back to the anchor. If you're slothy, you know, torpor, what are we going to do? We're going to, what? Open our eyes. Open our eyes. Bring in some energy. You can find the anchor even with your eyes open. And then when you go back, it's as if you are refreshed. Some of the most steadiest practice can come from this kind of regenerating interest when you're feeling sloth and torpor. Regenerating that interest adds to the steadiness of mind, and you will feel that sense of steadiness of mind. And the restlessness, the steadying your mind, having your mind be steady even when it's restless, put it back on the anchor. Everything in you may want to figure out stuff, solve this, but you are just letting the mind, you're like a dog. The mind is just throwing you sticks and you are running after these sticks, using up all your good practiced energy, this good gain of energy that you've been practicing with, and then instead of bringing it right back, you're using it up in thoughts. So instead, when you start noticing all that thinking, you got to say to yourself, the mind is stirred up, stirred up, stirred up. I need to bring it back into the anchor. Find the anchor, come back to it, keep coming back. And again, this coming back to the anchor from the sloth and torpor and the restlessness, it does something to our practice when we begin to see it is a superpower to be able to fast or restrain from following off in the mind. Solacy. I end up like done, you know, it's like I got all these pages and I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say with them. That's what ends up happening. You got so much stuff to say. And when you get up here, you just start talking. At least that's what I do. So I want to answer a couple of questions. One is, someone asked, how do you deal with aversive thinking? And I want to answer this directly, because I think that aversive thinking is energy. It is the energy of your practice, meaning that when you sit here and you're just steadying, it doesn't seem like you're doing anything, but it's generating energy. And that energy is actually wholesome, steady energy. But if we do not point it towards an anchor, it will be used in your aversive thinking. And that's where it's going. That anger, that aggression, that obsessive thinking that's happening is this energy. And so for a mind that's very aversive, just coming back to that anchor again and again and again. Two things that I have found help me a lot. I don't know why, but there's less thinking for me when I'm standing. So sometimes if there are sits like after lunch where there's going to be a lot of thinking, I would just stand through that whole sit come back to my anchor. It seemed as though I can access it more when I am not sitting with my eyes closed. Eyes open, that's another way. It's hard for the mind to get lost in its stories when the eyes are open. So sitting with your eyes open, the whole sit, might help with some of that aversive thinking. This aversive thinking, call it energy. Call it my mind sucking up the energy of my good practice. And you can tell because you have a great sit. It's almost peaceful. You're almost afraid to even admit it, like that 6 a.m. sit. And then the rest of the day is all thinking. Or the thinking happens towards the end of the day because you've spent all morning in this peaceful, generating all this energy. And then the afternoon, late afternoon, it's kind of like, I don't like doing those sits and I can't do it at night because my mind is just thinking. It's not thinking. It's sucking your energy that you've spent the whole day cultivating. And now your mind is going to start thinking about all kind of catastrophic things that aren't even going to happen. It's just making stuff up because it needs to do something with all this energy you're generating. And it needs to be put back into the practice to create stronger and stronger and stronger stability. So it says, why does the mind seek, this is the other one I wanted to answer. Why does the mind seek distraction when peace and joy is available through the breath? You know, especially if you hear, remember Don's talk, it's like, why would the mind want to be a distraction? So I get why distraction shows up as an avoidance of something like pain. But why just generally does the mind get distracted? So I think what's actually happening is that we are overly used to analyzing, evaluating. We use our ordinary minds all the time. We use it constantly all day long. It's habitual. We trust it. That's how we know what's real. That's how we know what's true. That's how we know what is us. I mean, that is the mind that we just use as life is life. So then when you come and you're trying to cultivate this present moment mind that's more this embodied mind, you're going to eventually have access to it. It's going to actually come when as days go on in a month long. That's why, you know, in a month long, there's plenty of time for that mind to come. But it, you don't have to wait 2 weeks for that mind. It's already here. Your body is here in the present moment. What I think this, what we call distraction, is our ordinary mind. And we have to actually develop and cultivate a relationship with our embodied or present moment mind. We have to actually spend as much time cultivating a relationship with this mind as we do our ordinary mind. So if you think of it as distracting you, then you don't see how normal it is, how natural it feels. We just go to it because that's what we have energy, and that's the mind that kind of like throws sticks at us. But instead, we actually want to cultivate and develop a mind that's steady in the present moment, in the same place where your body's at. And your body is in the present moment all the time. It never is not in the present moment. So we want to cultivate a mind that will stay steady with it. So I'll leave you with this last quote that a friend of mine is a Zen priestess. He, I don't know if this, to be honest, I don't know if this is something he made up. It's so beautiful to me. Or if it's something that he borrowed from someone else. But he posted it, and I just think it speaks to what we're doing with the concentration and the hindrances. He says, the wind is not entangled by the trees. The waters are not entangled by the rocks. The sound is not entangled by the sky. The universal flow is not entangled by the planets, stars, or galaxies. So just as the wind effortlessly moves through the trees, not grasping or clinging to them, so too we can move through life unencumbered. The trees may sway and bend in the wind's presence, but the wind remains free. And likewise, water effortlessly flows over and around rocks in its path. The rocks do not trap or confine the water. The water continues on its way unobstructed. Sound rings out in the open sky. It's not trapped or confined by the sky's vast expanse. The sky allows the sound to reverberate freely. In the same way, the infinite universal flow, which we all are a part of and flow through us, is not obstructed by the celestial bodies that populate space. The planets, stars, galaxies drift in the universal flow carried by its endless current. This is an encouragement, an invitation, that we too can move through life unimpeded. If we allow ourselves to flow like the wind and the water and sound, we are part of something so much greater than our individual existence that we call I. Through the practice and power of, he says, Zazen, but I'm going to say this connection with your anchor. Through the practice and power of this connection and returning to your anchor, not holding on to mind's attachments and points of resistance, we can flow freely wherever the universal current carries us as us. So we'll just be, he ends with, we are the practice itself. So we'll just let that be the last word here.